Glory to Ukraine, they chanted glory to the heroes. It's not everything, but it's a victory of sorts. Inside, the ceremony lasted just a few minutes. President Yanukovych did not smile. He's signing a deal that will limit his powers, force early elections, and a national unity government. Negotiations went right through the night. In the parliament, they were fighting with each other. The struggle here is taking many forms.
Love Bristol.
Love.
BCFM 93.2.
A Bristol kind of love.
What's this with all the triangles? The triangle on tanks in the army. And now you're seeing pyramids spring up everywhere, all over the place. Well, there's a method to their madness.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. A culture of cover-up when things go wrong at Bristol Royal Children's Hospital. Sound familiar? It seems Bristol United Bristol Hospital's NHS Trust, rather than learn from the 2001 Sir Ian Kennedy report, have brought a culture of cover-up, so Sir Ian's coming back to do it all again. Ten families and counting say their little ones were neglected at Bristol Royal Children's Hospital, Ward 32. So we hear from Schwag's Daphne Havercroft, who's been talking to some of the families. Plus, what was the real historical significance of the First World War? What with all those bangs and flashes, it's easy to lose sight of the social impact of the war and spin-off conflicts, such as the Irish Rebellion and the Russian Revolution. Channel 4 News' Paul Mason sets the agenda, while Martin Summers gives us the people's history of the Great War. Plus, a play questioning the official version of the 9/11 attacks is on in Redland's Little Black Box Theatre tonight and tomorrow. Former MI5 officer David Shaler is one of the actors, and I'll be asking him about the play, and also if he still thinks he's Jesus. Plus, Martin Summers takes us on his weekly tour of flashpoints, which no doubt will include Kiev and Ukraine and the financial markets. But first, I'm joined by Daphne Havercroft from SWAG, Southwest Whistleblowers Health Action Group. Hi, Daphne, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, Tony.
First of all, why did it take a tweet to get the NHS Medical Director, Sir Bruce Keogh, to respond to parents here in Bristol?
Well, it's an interesting one, and it shows the power of social media to get things done. But it shouldn't have had to happen like that, because Steve Turner, one of the dads, should not have had to tweet the NHS England Medical Director to get some action. And I think it's to do with the culture that the NHS knew that parents were concerned, the regulators knew parents were concerned, but nobody, in the words of Steve, picked up the reins and got on with it and dealt with it.
Is it just not possible then to pick up the phone or write a letter and get a response from Sir Bruce?
The parents had emailed him and had some acknowledgements, but they didn't feel that they were getting the response they need. And also, the role of journalists as well is important here, because the journalists picked up on this, and I don't think that if they hadn't taken an interest and got on to NHS England, that the meeting would have taken place, that took place last week.
Now, Sir Bruce Keogh has carried out reviews in other parts of the country, such as in Leeds. Should he have done that here in Bristol a bit earlier, do you think?
Well, I think he should, and he decided not to go in and do a review like he did in Leeds, and that raises some interesting questions, because with Leeds, the review that they did there, it was to look at clinical governance processes, and I would put under that umbrella things like risk management and how the hospital managed serious incidents, and also the staffing at Leeds and the skills of the staff. And these are exactly the same issues that parents have raised about Bristol, so it's odd that he didn't send in a team to have a look at what was going on in Bristol. And I just wonder, because the difference with Leeds is it's not a foundation trust and Bristol is. And in my mind, this raises questions about the relationship with between NHS England and foundation trusts. And maybe we should examine that further as things unfold with the Bristol story.
But what's the difference? How are they regulated differently? Most of us have got no idea how it actually would affect the way we can either communicate with the trust or the care that the trust delivers if it becomes a foundation trust. In a nutshell, what does it mean when a trust takes on foundation status?
Well, it means that they have more autonomy, so that any money that they make out of caring for people, they have more control over how they invest that money. They can keep more of it. They don't have to hand it back to the Department of Health. But then it raises questions about their accountability. And my view, I'm a member of the Bristol Trust, which doesn't give me any privileges. It just means that I'm a member of the public who put up my hand and said, yes, I'd like to be a member. They have targets to have so many members of the public as members of their trusts, but it doesn't give you any special rights or anything, or you get answers that other people don't get. But it seems to me the only way that they are accountable to the public is through governors, and it depends entirely on the quality of the governors and how they discharge their duties. And they're all volunteers. They don't get paid for this. To what extent a foundation trust is accountable to the public?
Okay, so the governors sound like quite important in any trust. How are they actually appointed or elected? How does that happen?
There's a different route. So the staff are allowed to elect so many governors to represent their interests, and patients and the public can elect governors as well. So they are appointed for terms of, I think, 3 or 4 years, and then they can stand for re-election.
As a member of the trust, you would be able to have some say in who's actually on the trust. Okay. Anyway, back to the problem in hand. Deborah Lee, the Deputy Chief Executive of University Hospitals Bristol, says that in their most recent survey of parents, 98% said they received excellent, very good or good care. That sounds very good, doesn't it? I mean, it's difficult to get. You know, why are you just focusing on this 2%?
Well, I'm sure that families who've used the children's services at Bristol, not just cardiac, but all the paediatric services, many of them will have experienced good care and lives will have been saved. You know, there's no question about that. Children go in who are seriously ill and they've got the skills and the techniques to be able to save lives. But some parents have not had good experiences. And I don't think it's helpful trotting out this 98% statistic, because it gives the impression of brushing off their concerns. And actually, it's pretty meaningless anyway, because just saying 98%, it doesn't tell you anything. So what I would want to know is, well, how many parents did they survey? Over what period did they survey them? Were parents who were known to have concerns asked the questions, or did they just look at people that they thought would give them good answers? What questions did they ask, and how many people responded?
Sir Bruce, he's the chief of the NHS, chief civil servant, said on Wednesday that he asked himself the question that perhaps matters most: would I allow my child to go into Bristol Children's Hospital today? The answer is yes, I would, he said.
He did, yes. And I guess my view is that, based on the information I've seen, if I had a child that needed those services, I'd have to say that at the moment my answer would be no, I wouldn't allow a child of mine to go in there.
So what have been the main problems? I mean, a lot of this is focused on Ward 32.
Yeah.
What have been the main problems with care? Because it does actually... The thing is, whenever patients are involved with a big organisation like the NHS, individual patients are going to be going through there, individual operations taking place. And if there is a pattern of problems, it's very, very unlikely that those parents will actually ever meet each other. That the only people that can really find out if there is a pattern, if there is a problem, is the health service itself. So what happened in this case where that parents actually started to realise themselves that there was a pattern developing?
Well, I think it goes back to what happened with the original heart problems, where it started off with a handful of parents, and then it comes back to the power of the media. When stories started to be told in public, and more parents realised that they weren't the only ones that had experienced problems, and that's how they came together. Parents, you know, they're a very powerful group of people. One of the strongest instincts in people is to protect your children, and that's what they've done. They've come together, and they can't change what has happened for their children, but what they do want is a safe service so that other families don't have to go through what they've gone through.
Now, one of the key things here is quite clearly, in a recovery ward from these operations for the children, it's important that there are good facilities for specialist care, that is to say high dependency units. Was that happening? Was it working at Bristol Children's Hospital?
Well, this is where the decision of Sir Bruce Keogh is interesting, because it seems that he's based his decision about not sending a team in to look at what's been going on purely on data which looks at the number of children that died within 30 days of primary surgery. And it doesn't seem to have taken into account the concerns that parents raised about post-operative care. So there's the big question about, well, why are you just focusing on mortality? Surely you should be looking at the quality and safety of the end-to-end care from when a child is admitted through surgery, through post-operative care and discharge, and follow-up care as well. And what we know is that Bristol, it was only since parents raised concerns and since the Care Quality Commission went in, that money was put forward by the commissioners, NHS England, to pay for high dependency care on Ward 32. So, yes, they have done what they needed to do, but actually, what does high dependency mean? Because there's various bits of data that show you that it's not just about putting beds in, it's having the right skilled staff there, it's having the right equipment, the right drugs, resuscitation equipment close to hand. And nobody seems to have looked at Bristol, or anywhere else for that matter, it's not just Bristol, and said, right, these are the standards of high dependency that it would be good if everyone had. Do you all have them? And if you haven't, are you taking steps to get those facilities in place?
Well, I noticed on the local BBC website and on Points West this week, Matthew Hill reports that Bristol Children's Hospital deaths, two more families come forward. Two more families who lost children after heart surgery at Bristol's Children's Hospital have come forward to express their concerns. Harley Pascoe from Fradden in Cornwall died in October, aged 12 days, and Mia Lee Snelson from nearby St Austell died in July, aged 11 days. It followed an announcement that there will be an inquiry into several deaths of children over recent years. The hospital's welcomed the review and says it hopes it will restore confidence. But this really does back up what you're saying there, Daphne, in that when there's some media coverage of something, even more families say, well, actually, I had questions about Bristol Children's Hospital.
Yeah. Well, I think there's an issue at board level. I don't doubt that Bristol has many dedicated staff, caring staff, working in the paediatric services and other services. But I think that they are let down by the leadership and culture of the trust board, because it's a culture that defends and denies, and it doesn't acknowledge concerns, and it doesn't, in my view, investigate them openly and transparently. And I think that's got to change for Bristol.
Just asking, I mean, you've obviously met some of these families. Are they pleased that there's been an interest taken and a formal inquiry is going to start?
Well, they're pleased that Sir Bruce came up with proposals for them to meet Sir Ian Kennedy, and it seems to be quite a different type of review, first of its kind, where he's actually said, well, it's for the parents and Sir Ian Kennedy to agree the terms of reference. But I think that there is some nervousness that actually, I think some of them would have liked as well for Sir Bruce to have sent in a team to look at Bristol now, because the Kennedy review is inevitably going to take time. Sir Bruce has said he didn't feel that there were any immediate urgent safety issues which would prompt a need to go in now, but the parents are rather nervous that, you know, maybe some of the information he's relying on is not entirely accurate, and they do have concerns that the trust, it's been very difficult to get information out of them. And I think many of the parents would like the NHS England to actually, you know, take the lead and go in and look at some of these things where parents don't feel they've been told all the facts.
I mean, in the Telegraph last Sunday, I mean, it was raging around the newsrooms last weekend. This news that there was to be another inquiry in Bristol of some sort. Anyway, and one of the most concerning things, it says Bristol Children's Hospital is still in denial, in inverted commas, about deaths, say parents. NHS Chief Sir Ruth Keogh has ordered an independent review into the Bristol Royal Hospital for Children following the deaths of newborn babies and infants. But the parents say, definitely, that the original recommendations following the tragedies have still not been carried out. I mean, that just sounds amazing. And you know, this must be an indicator, surely, as to whether there is a culture of secrecy and whether the management of the hospitals is up to the job when recommendations have been made for changes that have then been ignored.
Well, I'll give you an example of the trust's response to all this, because Steve Bolson, the original whistleblower who raised concerns that eventually led to the Kennedy inquiry, has publicly said that he finds that the same organisation has failed to learn from its mistakes, particularly galling. And I went to the Trust Board meeting on the 30th of January, and I raised that with the board. I said, are you aware of what Steve Bolson said? And I said there seems to be a disconnect between public perception of what's happened in the aftermath of the most recent inquests and what the trust is being told by the chief executive about the whole situation around these deaths. And Robert Woolley, the chief executive, said that the board wasn't necessarily aware of Steve Bolson's comments, the board took assurance from the chief executive that the circumstances of the 1990s did not apply today. And so my view is, well, actually, that is denial. You should look at the concerns that people are raising. You should acknowledge them. If you don't think they're relevant to what happened in the past, then you should be discussing it with people in an open and transparent manner. And that is not happening.
Okay, so where do we go from here then, Daphne? When is there likely to be some sort of delivery of this report and some changes? I mean, obviously, the more publicity this gets, the more families are coming forward who've had problems with the way their children were cared for in the hospital. But where do we go?
I think we have to keep an eye on what happens with the meeting between Sir Ian Kennedy and the parents. It would be great if they can agree some terms of reference and timescales to have this inquiry, and I think we need to see how that progresses and just keep an eye on it and monitor progress through your show, Tony.
Okay, well, there's that. Well, that's another way. But also, of course, you can join the trust and you can go along to their meetings, and also you can elect people onto the board of these foundation trusts who are actually going to.
Yeah, you can. The governors, yes.
The governors who can actually get a little bit more maybe a little bit more interested in the way the place is run and get some proper inquiries going, and also make sure that the complaint service works and that they're more open. So, Daphne Havercroft from SHWAG, that's Southwest Whistleblowers Health Action Group. You're online at swwhag www.wordpress.com. Thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you, Tony.
And now, before our next item, which is former MI5 officer David Shaler's play he's doing tonight and tomorrow night, we're going to hear from Sochi and from the Red Army Choir. This is really well worth watching on YouTube, because these various battalions of the Red Army do make quite a good job of this song for the Olympics.
Beginnings. What keeps the planets bringing? The force of the beginning. Look. I'm giving. What is this I'm feeling? If you want to live, I'm ready.
Not a bad attempt, actually, there from the Red Army Choir, from the, I believe, the opening ceremony of the Sochi Olympics. And nice to see that they've had a couple of weeks there pretty much so far, not wanting to wish to tempt fate without any big bomb attacks and things like that at the Olympics, as was being feared after the Volgograd attacks a few weeks ago. Anyway, I'm joined now by a former MI5 officer turned actor, David Shaler. Hi, David. Welcome
Hello
to the
there.
Politics Show.
Hello.
You're doing a play called 7 Seconds tonight and tomorrow night down at the little Black Box Theatre, Chandos Road in Redland. Tell us about what drew you to this play.
Well, a friend of mine who was in the 9/11 truth movement from many moons ago just told me he'd written this play.
And I met him for some other reason. Then he just phoned up and said, "Do you fancy being in it?" So I said, "Yeah, okay then." And ironically, I'm actually playing a journalist, a real human being called James Bone, who works for The Times. And the bits in there from the journalists are all real information from their articles. So I slag off conspiracy theorists in it. And there's other journalists there as well who work for The Independent and so on. George Monbiot, David Aranovich, all the kind of favourites that we know, who we've tried to engage about the truth about 9/11, who then turned round and tried to ridicule us, essentially.
But you say the truth, but surely that's something that has to be fought for. You know, there's all sorts of different versions of what the truth is, and it's really up to journalists to present different versions, and for really the readers and the viewers and the listeners to make their own decision about what's true and what isn't, surely.
Yeah, and that's done by adducing evidence and having a rational debate. It's not done by people like George Monbiot slagging off conspiracy theorists and saying, you know, we're all kind of, you know, swivel-eyed loons.
But surely that's the part of the debate, isn't it?
No, I don't think it is. The attacking the person who brings the argument to the table is a very old trick used by various people who don't know how to debate properly. But you want to get it truth, it's done through the actual information and the analysis of that information. And the internet has served over the last 5 or 6 years as a kind of peer review process. When some new information about 9/11 comes out, everybody wants to have their tuppence worth about it. And through that process, I think you do get to truth.
Well, you say peer review, but actually a lot of people would say it's just a bunch of amateurs who are spouting off, a lot of them anonymously online. They're not saying who they are or anything. So you can't really compare that to a proper professional peer review.
Well, you can, because people will bring their expertise. And obviously your job is to show discernment, is not to just simply accept things you see on the internet. But generally speaking, on the internet, when somebody writes a paper, they will link to their source material. A bit like, for example, Operation Northwoods, where the American military had a plan to carry out false flag operations across America to provoke an invasion of Cuba. That is a matter of record. People can go on the internet and they can read those documents for themselves. And that is a tonic to people who say, well, governments wouldn't do this kind of thing. Clearly they do. Clearly it's part of policy. When you start doing researching this stuff, you realise there have been several incidents, like the second Gulf of Tonkin incident in 1964, which didn't happen, but nevertheless escalated the Vietnam War. We have the sinking, almost sinking, of the USS Liberty in 1967, in which President Johnson essentially wanted to allow that ship to go down to provoke a war between Egypt and Israel. It didn't happen because some Russians were flying over and were able to witness what really went on.
Now, one of the main things, it's called 7 seconds, the play. The 7 seconds refers to the time it took for Building 7, the third tower, to fall on 9/11 in New York City as part of the World Trade Center. What was that building? Because this hasn't been, most of us have seen the pictures of the two twin towers of the World Trade Center coming down, but not this other building.
Yeah, people don't realize that at 5:20 that day local time, a 47-story skyscraper collapsed into its own footprint in about 6.57 seconds. The research that's been done by people who've analysed this frame by frame show that at one point it's falling faster than if you allow for air resistance. There's no air resistance there. Somehow a vacuum's being created. Now, that's not a falling building. There's clearly some kind of explosion going on then that creates the vacuum and sucks the building
down.
Well,
I mean, if you look at the footage on the internet, it has to say, rather like the Twin Towers themselves, it does look like one of these controlled demolitions where, you know, we see an old load of tower block in Sheffield or whatever coming down.
Yeah,
comes down at that pretty much the same speed.
Yeah, well, in the BBC Conspiracy Files programme, which they were trying to diss, that's there, they actually showed a controlled demolition split screen with Building 7 coming down, and it comes down at exactly the same rate as a controlled demolition. But then there was no explanation or cross-examination from the other side about why that should be the case. They just said, well, it looks a bit like a controlled demolition, but it's not. I mean, what sort of kind of rational approach is that? And when you start to realise that actually what was housed in Building 7 is quite important. There were certain departments of the American federal government in there, but crucially the Security Exchange Commission was in there, who were investigating these scandals around things like Enron and World.com. And as a result of that, the papers from those investigations were lost.
No, the Securities and Exchange Commission is really the regulator for the New York Stock Exchange and much of the New York, the US Wall Street financial world. Interesting that they should be destroyed as well, even though no plane went into their building.
Yeah,
and also, even, you know, coming up to date, we've got inquiries going on now into fraud in the City of London, where fraudsters are being, evidence is being presented and published to show that individuals in the city have not have done things wrong, fraudulently or whatever, broken the law, criminals, and yet the city doesn't prosecute them. the US Security and Exchange Commission is prosecuting these people, sometimes extraditing them, sometimes prosecuting them in absentia. So these kinds of regulators are actually really important, and it seems in the Western world, the Security and Exchange Commission is one of the only regulators with teeth.
Yeah, no, but we've still got lots of cases like the LIBOR fixing scandal, the recent Bank of England
fraud,
stuff about
fraud.
Fixing. Yeah, it's all fraud, but nobody seems to get... Although they have actually announced recently that they are taking action against a couple of people involved. But that's really too little too late.
The thing is, reminds me a bit of the fines, Dave, in these cases, they're getting fined, these institutions. Now, all that Barclays have to do if they want to pay a fine is go into one of their offices, get on a computer terminal, press a couple of zeros, and then they've paid their fine.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. They can just create money out of thin air, yeah. No, there's no disincentive. But this is partly why I believe that we've got to try to adopt the common law, basically. And the common law is a very simple law. It says do as you would be done by. And that is recognised as a higher law throughout their system. People don't realise this, that if you look at, for example, Magna Carta, if you know, you understand the language of Magna Carta, it's showing you that the common law is a higher law. There's a piece of case law called Donoghue versus Stevenson, and judges are bound by case law in their system, that shows that the common law comes above any contract law, and a contract won't protect you from being sued under common law. But the interesting thing about this is it shows that usury is unlawful. Now, if you want to bring the system down peacefully, I would say to everybody out there with a mortgage, use the standard letter I've got on my website, send it off to your mortgage company. We haven't used this for mortgages yet, no one's been brave enough to do it, but we have used it for credit card debts, for TV licences, for council tax, for parking and speeding fines, and we have a 100% success rate. This letter seals them off completely.
The thing is, usury is one way of saying interest. Interest is legal.
It's not, though, that's the point. If you actually do your research into it, usury is unlawful, and that which is unlawful cannot be made legal, basically. What they've got is they're just turning a blind eye to it. But when you do the research into usury, you realise that it is actually unlawful. And I'll say this letter revolves around the fact that as a human being, you have more rights than any corporation. A corporation has no rights under the common law because it can't take responsibility for its actions.
But the actual practicality of it is it seems to be the opposite way around. The corporations seem to have all the rights. They don't get prosecuted. They don't get done for corporate manslaughter.
But that's because they are being judged by their system. When you go into a courtroom, you're not being judged under common law. You're being judged under their corporate law. Now, of course, you as an individual is never going to win in those circumstances. But again, I've got some tricks up my sleeve for dealing with judges. You've got to get the judge under oath in a courtroom. This causes all sorts of problems. When I've got in there and defended people, you ask the judge he's under oath, he will go mad. He'll start shouting at you and stuff like that.
Well, it doesn't sound necessarily like a way to win a court case. Anyway, look, let's just talk about you, because, Dave, many people realise that you, back in, I think it was around about 2008, was it, you decided that you were Jesus. What was that about? And do you still think that?
Yeah, I still think I'm Jesus Christ. To be clear what that means, my claim is based on three unique aspects. I'm not claiming to be a reincarnation of Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ didn't come 2,000 years ago.
So, Jesus Christ wasn't there 2,000 years ago. Someone else, was it?
Well, what happened is, what you've got to understand is that Jesus is in fact a reincarnating soul. I'm the last incarnation of the soul. 2,000 years ago, a man called John the Divine incarnated from that soul and was a wandering spiritual teacher, and people therefore confused his teachings and so on with him being the Messiah, although he never said to anybody
he was the
Messiah.
So how do you know all this?
A lot of it comes through divine revelation, but through research.
What, is that reading the Bible?
The Bible's been an enormous influence, obviously. I did have a moment with the Book of Revelation when I finally made sense of it, and I went back to the moment as John the Divine when I'd written these codes into Revelation for my final incarnation, me, to know that it was the end times, basically.
Okay, so you haven't recounted any of that I'm Jesus stuff. Anyway, look, let's just get back to this this play, because there's an organisation, isn't there, called Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. 2,000 experts who are calling for an independent investigation into the destruction of the Twin Towers and Building 7. I mean, how is what you're doing as a play linked to what they are doing as an organisation?
There's no formal link as such. What we do, though, is we use a lot of their research and material in the play. And again, I'd say to anybody who doesn't know this stuff, get on the internet, look these people up. There's an excellent documentary out there in which they take you through it stage by stage. You don't have to be a scientist to understand this. So we don't have no direct connection as such, but we do use their material, but anybody can, of course, freely use that material.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, I know you're part of an organisation called Reinvestigate 9/11. First, why is it that you feel that 9/11 needs a reinvestigation?
Well, basically, there's all sorts of evidence that's come out over the last number of years.
I mean, in your view, is this this building seven, the 7 seconds it took, is that quite an, actually quite an important aspect of it?
It is a very important aspect of it, and if people don't know about this, they can just do a simple web search, WTC7, and you can see for yourself the third building that collapses. And why architects and engineers have concentrated on this is because they've done surveys of people, and they find that many people do not know that three buildings collapsed. They think only two buildings collapsed. And when they are shown the video of the third building and then said, what do you think of that? Lots of people say, hang on a minute, why haven't we been told about this? That doesn't look right. Because, of course, no plane hit the building.
Yeah.
So it can't possibly be a fire from jet fuel, which doesn't make sense.
They're in very good company, because the 9/11 Commission clearly didn't know Building 7 fell down either. They mentioned Building 7 in the report, but at no point in that report does it mention this building comes down.
I'll tell you someone who was more informed than the 9/11 Commission, that's the BBC, because Jane Stanley was reporting for the BBC, and she actually announced, didn't she, that Building 7 had collapsed something like 20 minutes before it actually happened. Now, Martin, this is very... It starts to get very, very strange. How can the BBC announce the collapse of Building 7 20 minutes before the collapse actually takes place?
Let's think about this. It doesn't mean that the BBC are in on the conspiracy. It means that somebody went round and said, oh, Building 7's going to collapse. And in fact, various people said, were told... I mean, there's evidence come out that people were told to leave the building, so hardly anybody was killed in the building because they evacuated it because it was going to be taken down. I suspect happened, and this is speculation, is that the third plane, which never made it to New York, was supposed to crash into that building.
Oh, this is the one that crashed in Shanksville. It was shot down.
Well, we don't know. But the point is, the main point we need to get through to the audience of this show and in general is that we don't know what happened. And the government haven't been able to tell us in the last 15 years. An obvious point to make to people, Building 7 is an obvious one, the other very obvious point to make to people, what happened to the United States Air Force defending the most heavily defended airspace on the planet, including the Pentagon, which must be the most heavily defended.
Well, I'll tell you what the answer is. They were caught on the hop, weren't they?
We should know how they were caught on the hop. Yeah. Don't forget, you know, in World War II, during the Battle of Britain, and there were, 60 or something, 70 planes in the US.
But, I mean,
who went off course.
Martin, just a minute. This is peacetime. This is the whole point, is this was a surprise attack. The US air defences were not ready. Possibly they were ready for the Russians to send bombers over, but they weren't expecting this.
Let me make a logical point, Tony. If they weren't ready, after all of this time and on the investigations that have taken place, we should have a straightforward side of A4 that explains why they weren't ready. And anybody should be able to explain what happened.
Yeah.
Now, I put it to people listening that the missile defences around the Pentagon, which are supposed to shoot down anything which overflies it, somebody must have switched those off. And where was the United States Air Force? It may just be a mess-up. Maybe somebody messed up and they didn't do their job properly. Why haven't we heard who it was? Now, in actual fact, none of these planes were intercepted on the way to the target, even though they were in US airspace for over an hour and a half. Now,
we think one was and shot down the Shanksville.
Well, we don't know. We don't know.
Well, it was in a field. The plane was in a field.
The point is, what tends to happen with this is everybody wants to be Hercule Poirot or Miss Marple, and they want to
Actually, what most people want is someone to do it for them.
Well, true.
Yeah, but the fact is that the main point we need to make is these basic facts about 9/11 have not been addressed. What happened to Building 7? That clearly wasn't caused by an aeroplane fire. Where were the Air Force? And of course, we've got NATO intelligence services, as David well knows, have got a track record of engaging in provocational terrorism. And Francesco Imposimato, who's the head of the Italian Supreme Court, wrote a book that came out at the end of last year about bombings and shootings in Italy, and it's based upon his investigations as a magistrate, head of the Supreme Court, lots of police investigations, absolutely clear, NATO intelligence services were the terrorists.
Was Italy in the 1970s. Yes, this is America in 2001.
Yes, but the point is that NATO intelligence services have a documented track record of engaging in provocational terrorism. The bombing of Bologna railway station killed 80 people. 3,000 odd people were killed on 9/11. But there's no moral difference between the two. If they're prepared to kill 80 people, they're prepared to kill 3,000 people.
The really barbaric attacks that target civilians seem to be carried out by either NATO or whoever we think it is.
That's right.
It's carried out by the armed forces who are supposed to be protecting us.
Vincenzo Vinciguerra in the film about Gladio says exactly that. We targeted ordinary people because we're trying to scare the pants off them.
Exactly.
The IRA targeted ordinary people by accident. They blew things up, which they didn't intend to. People died. Yeah. They were very careless about it. But actually, what they were doing, they killed lots of police officers and soldiers.
Yeah, they didn't target civilians. And this is what you've got to bear in mind as well. A lot of people who go out to the Middle East to join conflicts is they are genuine resistance fighters who want to remove an unlawful occupying force. And indeed, they have the common law on their side. But they are not the same people who would have the mentality to indiscriminately attack civilians. I mean, I've worked in terrorism, therefore I understand the difference. And lots of people don't understand that difference. And I have to say, you know, the case in this country of the four so-called 7-7 bombers, none of them fit any of the profile of suicide Absolutely. Bombers at all. Anybody who does any research into their lives, these were not desperate people. They were on the process of getting married, having kids, having careers and so on. And again, you know, with 7-7, there is no official story for you to attack. There's an official narrative, but that is so wrong that they got the actual time the train these guys are supposed to have taken from Luton wrong, because that train was cancelled that day. So the whole official narrative falls down. It's all based on stuff that we're not allowed to openly examine, and anybody who's intelligent should want to have, you know, transparent evidence they can examine
for
themselves.
Weirdly, there's a bit of a link between the 7-7 London bombings and the Securities and Exchange Commission investigating body we were talking about earlier, because one of the companies that had taken over privatisation of the tube, taken over their surveillance variant systems, was and still is a Israeli owned company. The chief of it, Daniel Bodner, is a former Israeli, Israeli, there's conscription in Israel. He's a former officer in their Corps of Engineers in Israel. He was the chief executive of this company in charge of surveillance on the London Underground. Now, I found it extraordinary, Martin, that London Underground themselves are not in charge of their own CCTV cameras and their own surveillance system. Anyway, his company, the parent company, Converse Technologies, also Israeli, was under massive investigation by the Securities and Exchange Commission for what's called stock option backdating. That is that the directors had pretended that they bought and sold shares at various times in the past to make their share portfolio massive, to make loads of money out of it. And he absconded with $13 million, their chief executive of this firm, which is in charge of security on the London Undergrounds on 7-7. So you've got an absolute web of intrigue, as well as private security, right at the heart of a big attack like 7-7.
Well, yes, and of course on 9-11 itself, all three airports the planes took off from, where the security was in charge of ICTS, which again is an Israeli security company, and Schiphol Airport was also controlled by ICTS when the so-called underpants bomber was taken onto the plane without any security checks at all. Now, we're getting into deep waters here for people who are newbies into this kind of topic.
But I mean, is there any kind of way of, if there is a terrorist attack, God forbid, in the future, of looking at it, seeing how it's kind of transpiring on our TV screens? Obviously, you've got to press record. That's one of the first things to do. But is there any way of looking at how it transpires, looking for signals that maybe that it is a false flag attack, as we're saying potentially the 9/11 attack?
Well, first point I would make is it's always going to be a question: is this attack carried out by the security forces? It may or may not be. But the first question you've got to ask is it, because we've got a track record of them doing exactly that. Yeah. So when we talk about 9/11 is the cherry on the cake of NATO provocational terrorism that goes back to the 1940s, and if people don't believe that, they should just have a check on just put Gladio into your search engine, and it will all come up. The Gladio stay behind networks in Western Europe were engaged in terrorism. That's according to decades of investigation by the Italian police force, not by people like you and me, people with the resources to do so. Now, in actual fact,
parliamentary inquiries,
Inquiries in Switzerland, in Belgium, and in Italy have all concluded exactly the same. Andreotti, the former prime minister of Italy, admitted that it was the case. There's no dispute about it. But out there in Radio 4 land, and people who listen to the BBC, they go, oh, that can't possibly be right. Now, the fact of the matter is, MI6 have been terrorists for many, many years. And David will probably comment on this in relation to Gaddafi and Libya. They've actually got a track record of going round being terrorists. Now, nobody on the Falls Road in Belfast is surprised, but of course a lot of people in Surrey are. But then people in Surrey don't get out much, do they?
David, just getting back to the play again, is it a good play?
It's a good play because it's a good introduction to 9/11. It takes you through all the evidence about Building 7. So it deals with, for example, this report produced by the National Institute of Science and Technology in the US that's created this computer model. And again, many people look at a computer model, but the computer model doesn't actually collapse. They take it up to the point of collapse. And what you actually see happening in the computer model is the building wobbles. You don't see that in the video. In the video, you see a building coming straight down its footprint. So the computer model is an absolute load of nonsense. It took them 7 years after the attacks to produce it, and this is more attempts to try and whitewash it. But it does take you further into the whole thing about the discovery of nanothermite there, and this has been tested by physicists and so on. This is something that cannot be produced by an organisation like Al-Qaeda. It's clearly the work of a government or some other highly funded organisation. So this is where we look at the smoking guns, and you're not going to get evidence, a piece of paper saying, you know, we planned the 9/11 attacks. That doesn't work like that in the New World, or they don't leave that kind of evidential trail. So what you've got to do is apply your reason to it. And when you see a substance that is beyond the capability of Al-Qaeda to produce, but would be capable by the American military, you've got to conclude that this is some kind of inside job.
Okay. David Shader, former MI5 officer turned actor. What else are you up to these days?
I've actually been doing a lot of interviews with the People's Voice. I've been getting back into things. I had a quiet 4 years where I lived on eco projects. I lived without money for 4 years as part of my spiritual mission. That was difficult at times, but I've got to be absolutely honest and say that the God looked after me. I never wanted for food. I never went without a roof over my head. And now I've come through that. I'm now in the process of engaging with the other side again. And uniquely, I have solutions. A lot of people can talk about the problems of the world, but I have the solutions. And people who want to look at my research, they can find it on www.scribd.com/David_Shaler. And they will find, you know, stuff there about how they can try and get out the system. They'll find stuff about things like growing hemp, which is the way forward, because hemp can solve all sorts of problems to do with starvation on the planet, fuel. It's a clean fuel. There's been research done in America to show that actually the Americans, without using arable land, could grow enough hemp to fuel them, and they're voracious consumers of fuel.
Okay, lovely. Now, smoke and mirrors of 9/11, partially anyway. The mirror is cleaned for us tonight and tomorrow, so that's at the Little Black Box Theatre, 2 Chandos Road in Redland. Tickets are between 8 and £12, and it starts at 7:30 this evening and tomorrow night. David Shaler, former MI5 officer, thanks very much for joining us.
Cheers, thank you very much.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Now, Martin Summers, how would you tell the real story in 4 TV episodes of the First World War, Martin? Let's start by looking at some of the causes. Imperialism.
Imperialism. Well, what is imperialism? Often people think of imperialism, they talk about Lenin's theory of imperialism, but most people don't realise that Lenin's theory of imperialism was actually based upon a theory by a liberal thinker in Britain called E.A. Hobson. He was the one that said that developed the theory of imperialism, which Lenin eventually copied. And basically, he was saying that competition between big, imperialist countries like Britain and France, for example, and Germany, ultimately leads to war because they're fighting over markets, they're fighting over access to resources, and that this basically leads to war. And this was a theory developed before the First World War by a liberal thinker based here in Britain, but actually taken up by Lenin, and of course who made it famous because he was the leader of the Bolshevik Revolution.
What about the effect that it has on the domestic population? Because obviously, for example, you look at both of the wars, what it did is it solved problems at home, didn't it? Domestic problems. I mean, for example, in the 1930s, there was a massive unemployed movement. All these people were then, the empire could then say, well, to all these people, right, you've got to now join the army and go off and fight.
Well, I mean, it's from Henry V, isn't it? Shakespeare, to giddy simple minds with foreign quarrels. When you've got social tensions at home, you've got problems with trying to keep everybody in line. And in Britain before the First World War, there were big social tensions. You've got the Irish independence movement. You've got the syndicalist trade unionism pushing for higher wages and workers' control of industry. And you've also got the suffragettes demanding votes for women, all of whom were prepared to use extra parliamentary tactics to get their goals. So Britain was actually on the verge of revolution in 1914, but in actual fact the war squashed all of that for the time being, although of course these things always come back.
Okay, what about the Balkan conflict, national chauvinism?
Well, I mean, we saw this in the 1990s when I was an aid worker over there. The Balkans is the place where people go to settle their scores. So you've got all of these different ethnic groups intermingled, and they've all got protectors, and my dad's bigger than your dad scenario begins to develop. So you get Croatia backed by Germany and America taking on Serbia backed by Russia, etc. And the Balkans was the flashpoint for the First World War, because all of the tensions between the big powers were played out there. And we've got plenty of places like the Balkans around, dotted around the world now. I mean, Ukraine is now performing the same kind of role in potentially in relation to World War III and Syria as the Balkans played in the 1900s. But of course, the Balkans is still a very serious source of tension in world politics.
And to what extent was the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand actually really the cause of World War One, and who was the guy?
Well, Archduke Ferdinand was the heir to the throne of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and he was assassinated by a Serbian extremists who were actually being helped by the Serbian government, the royalist government of Serbia. Now, they claimed that they were not helping him, that it was a deniable terrorist group. But the Austrian government took the view that the Serbian government were definitely responsible for the assassination. The Serbs denied it, but I think historical evidence suggests that they did have some hand in it. And then the Austrians then used that as an excuse to say to the Serbs, right, we're going to attack you because you've killed Archduke Ferdinand. And of course, British people have got to remember that the Austrians were responding to the Serbs assassinating their leader. And then, of course, we went to war to protect Serbia. So, were we on the right side or the wrong side?
Okay, fascinating. Do you think it really was the cause? I mean, you know,
well, that was the proximate cause. That was the proximate cause. Every year. I mean, just as World War II, the proximate cause was Hitler's invasion of Poland. But of course, the Japanese had already invaded China several years previously. And if there had been a decision to fight over Czechoslovakia, then it would have been the invasion of Czechoslovakia that caused World War II. So the proximate cause could vary, because the real tension is the underlying tension between the power structures in Germany, Britain, Russia, etc.
Now, the next point in Paul Mason's sketch, because Paul Mason, the Channel 4 news chap, used to be a BBC Newsnight economics guy, sketched out some ideas around a programme to do with the real First World War. The next point is the arms race and technology.
Yeah, I mean, you had an arms race, particularly around battleships between Britain and Germany. Germany wanted basically Britain had used its navy to dominate, you know, the extra European world. The Germans didn't have any colonies. And of course, what actually happened in the war is that the British blockaded Germany, therefore creating shortages and hunger inside Germany. The Germans then retaliate by the U-boat campaign against Britain's supply lines in the Atlantic. But of course, both sides started to build up their battleships, and as one side built up its battleships, the other side felt that it had to build up its battleships, and so an arms race ensued, similar to the one between the Soviet Union and the US in the Cold War period.
Okay, what about organised monopolised economies?
Ah, well, this is a key one, because what begins to happen, capitalism, the final stage of imperialism, as Lenin called it, is, early capitalism has got lots and lots of small entrepreneurs rushing around creating people like Wedgwood and Arkwright and so on. But eventually capitalism settles down to become a stable system, which involves investment in research and development, long-term planning, big organisations with an internal hierarchy. And the Germans in particular were very good at making new scientific discoveries into serviceable business ideas. And they were systematic about it. Now, of course, what they're doing by doing that, and the US were doing the same thing, was taking the British Empire's markets. And ultimately that leads to tension, because that means that you're going to get something and we're not going to get it. And those kind of tensions are still palpable in the world today.
Societies in denial, the Edwardian Belle Epoque and social liberalism.
Well, there was a general view, and I think the First World War blew it out of the water, that human society was on an improving arc. And that was right across the spectrum. Everybody believed this. The liberals believed that free trade would improve human society. Conservatives believed that if everybody just stuck to their traditional values, that society would improve. And the communists even believed, and the Marxists even believed, that society was improving, possibly through conflict and war, but in any case, improving. I think standing as we do in the 21st century, in 2014, it's quite obvious that there's not necessary that society should improve. And if you look at the long spread of human history with the collapse of civilizations like ancient Egypt and so on. In actual fact, things can go backwards just as easily as they can go forwards.
Well, it's almost like social inequalities there. Also, control of technology is also in a very few hands. Right. Labour movements, anarchism and socialism.
Well, of course, before the First World War, the socialist movement had developed very, very strongly across Europe. And, of course, even in the US, you had the industrial workers of the world who were an internationalist movement. And the Second International, which was founded in the 19th century, basically had all of the... it still exists. I mean, the Labour Party, of which I'm a member, is still part of the Socialist International. They had a policy that if the ruling classes of Germany, Britain and whoever else decided to have a war, then there would be a general strike across Europe which would stop that war from happening. And in the run-up to war, that all fell apart. Jean Jaurès, who is the head of the French Socialist Party, was assassinated by a right-wing fanatic. And the trade unions in Germany, France and elsewhere were unable, because everybody believed that they were under attack. And so the policy of trying to call a general strike to stop the war just fell apart. In Germany, where the labour movement was strongest, they were told, look, the Russians are invading us, and if we don't defend the fatherland, we're going to have the Tsar running things around here. So this is the thing that people in Britain don't quite grasp. Why were the Germans... why were the German socialists... the German socialists didn't really support the war, but why would the German working class initially support the war? Because they thought they were being invaded by Russia, who was our ally.
Okay. Yeah. Finally tonight, the outbreak and the race to the sea, Tannenberg. What was Tannenberg?
Well, Tannenberg was when the Russian army tried to invade Germany, and the Germans, who were basically fighting on two fronts, were able to surround and destroy them at the Battle of Tannenberg, which, of course, put Russia onto the slippery slope towards revolution. And it's often forgotten in the West that our major ally in the war was Tsarist Russia, and ordinary people in Germany felt Tsarist Russia was more of a threat than anything else.
OK, fascinating, Martin. Over the next few weeks, we'll be looking also at Paul Mason's behest at the slaughter, the revolutions and the aftermath of the First World War. But bringing us back up to date, in a nutshell, Ukraine, Martin.
Well, Ukraine has been... I've been watching with great concern what's been going on this week. There's a real potential here for a Yugoslavia-style situation, because Ukraine isn't really one whole country. You've got two major groups: the Ukrainian-speaking people in the West who look to Europe, and the Russian-speaking people in the East who look to Moscow. And that could be Bosnia writ large.
But what about the major players on both sides?
Well, the players on both sides... I mean, we're talking...
Is it remote from Ukraine, do you think?
No, it's not. I mean, coming back to the First World War, what you've got is exactly the kind of geopolitical tensions that led to the First World War are now being expressed in Ukraine and elsewhere, in Syria, for example.
OK, well, time to sign off now. Murdoch News at 7, up in a minute, and Cyrus Tavares with his typical tropical, Afro-tropical show. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Councillor for Whitchurch Park and leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council, Helen Holland. Thanks also to Daphne Havercroft from Schwag, and also to former MI5 officer David Shaler. Next week, more on the First World War, plus our news review. I'm Tony Gosling. Online at thisweek.org.uk. See you next week.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, world leaders are watching Kiev to see if a deal agreed between opposition groups and Ukraine's president will hold. It was struck this afternoon and we'll see a new constitution and a new unity government. Huge crowds of protesters are still gathering in the centre of the capital, though. Here's former boxer